But with the absence of personnel, it's going to be easier for, you know, governments to find security loopholes, security vulnerabilities.
Social media platforms, including Twitter, have made increasing efforts to moderate content. Elon Musk, the multi-billionaire CEO of Tesla and SpaceX, has been a vocal public critic of Twitter's content moderation efforts. This complaint was a driving force behind this decision to acquire the social media company this year. Elon Musk's acquisition of Twitter has had immense consequences all around the world. How do governments regulate social media content moderation efforts while balancing international human rights and free speech norms? Professor David Kaye joins us today to discuss the global chaos following Elon Musk's Twitter acquisition. David Kaye is a clinical professor of law at the University of California, Irvine, and the former United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of the Right to Freedom of Opinion and Expression from 2014 to 2020. He has reported to the UN on COVID-19 and freedom of expression and to the UN General Assembly on online hate speech. Professor Kaye, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Right, so social media companies have internal content moderation rules. And one of Elon Musk's biggest issues with Twitter prior to his acquisition had been its content moderation. So to situate our discussion today, why do social media companies moderate content?
That is a great question to start with. And the truth of the matter is that every social media company, every platform that any of, you know, your friends or your listeners use has some form of content moderation. They have rules, they have guidelines, whatever they call them. They have basically a system for determining, you know, basically at the margins, because most content is not problematic for the platform. So at the margins, what, you know, kind of content do they not want to appear or have appear or host on their platforms? And so they've created many rules. I mean, the truth of the matter is almost all of the platforms started at the beginning with a very modest set of rules, you know, almost no rules at all. And, you know, early on, Twitter sort of famously referred to itself as the free speech wing of the Free Speech Party. And that was sort of a suggestion that all kinds of debate, all kinds of discussion could be available to people on the platform. The problem was that, you know, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, you know, every platform saw that, you know, and pretty early on, that people might use the platform for problematic content. They might use it, for example, to harass other users, to sort of, in a way, push them off the platform. They might use the platform in order to incite violence or hatred against particular groups. They might use it for, you know, different forms of fraud, which, you know, might be under the broader category of disinformation, but also use it for real problematic ends. And so the platforms basically started to develop, as part of their terms of service, rules that would guide users in terms of, you know, what kind of content would they take action against, you know, which might include removing the content, you know, for repeat violators, maybe removing the user altogether. But that's essentially, in a nutshell, why the rules developed, and they've developed into kind of a, for many of the platforms, a kind of rich set of, you know, almost like platform law to govern what's legitimate to say and not say, or post or not post on their platforms.
So what is the relationship between content moderation by private social media corporations and the requirements set by governments?
So, the language that we use in order to talk about what companies do and what governments do highlights the difference, right? So, you know, when we talk about what companies do, we tend to say they moderate content, right? Because in effect, they're acting as moderators among the kinds of content that they're hosting, among people who are speaking. They're moderators, like you're at, you know, traditionally at a in-person event, and there's a moderator among a panel of people, and you don't want people speaking over each other or calling each other names or whatever that might be. Now, I mean, those aren't the rules online, but that's where the moderator name comes from. And we think of what governments do as regulating. So companies moderate, governments regulate. Governments can bring, you know, the full power of law to platform governance, to content, to speech. In democratic countries, generally, you know, our view in, you know, in democracies is that government shouldn't be in the business of regulating speech. Certainly that's the case in the United States under the First Amendment, where, you know, the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of the press or of speech. And in so doing, we see that government or the Constitution is focused directly on a limitation on government. It's actually not all that different around the world. So most countries around the world have adopted some form of speech protection. Typically, it can be aligned with international human rights law, which in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, it says that everybody, so it's sort of flipped around, not focused on government per se, but everybody enjoys the right to freedom of expression, which means the right to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas of all kinds, regardless of frontiers and through any media of one's choice. And it imposes restrictions on what government can do to limit that right of freedom of expression. And so generally speaking, when we talk about governments regulating content, we're in a zone of, I would say, a zone of caution, where we're really closely examining what is the government actually doing? Are they limiting speech? When they're limiting speech, do they have a legitimate justification? For example, limiting it because of incitement to violence? Are they limiting it because it involves defamation or interfering with the rights of others? And so that's where we get, you know, the different kinds of language. And to bring it all back to your question, governments around the world have increasingly, you know, been concerned about the kind of content that they see online, and yet they often don't have the tools to limit that speech unless they violate human rights norms. So, for example, they may say they don't like to see harassment, or they don't like to see hate speech. But generally speaking, human rights law doesn't allow those governments to simply restrict that kind of speech. And so we see this kind of tension between what governments want to limit because they see some kinds of harms of disinformation or hate speech or racism, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, all of that kind of basket of things we might think of as harms, and they struggle to figure out how they can actually restrict that kind of content, in part because restricting it raises some potentially serious human rights concerns.
So with those restrictions in mind and this tension that you're talking about, does the U.S. Sort of require content moderation? Like, what do those regulations look like with this tension in mind?
I mean, with few exceptions, actually, the government of the United States, instead of requiring content moderation, it's basically given the companies immunity, that is immunity from liability in the courts, from their content moderation decisions. I mean, and that means that, you know, companies can either decide to moderate content or decide not to. Now, most of them decide to moderate content because they don't want to be cesspools of hatred and harassment and bullying and misogyny. They don't want that because that's bad for business. So they adopt rules that restrict that kind of content, but they're not, you know, per se required to do that. Now, in some areas, there are requirements. If there's, you know, illegal content, for example, certain kinds of terrorist content, threats, real threats to violence, incitement to violence, content that involves child endangerment, that kind of content falls under, areas of illegal speech, let's say, that is generally prohibited, not only online. But apart from those areas, generally speaking, U.S. law does not require the companies to moderate content.
Right. And I kind of want to pivot specifically back to Twitter and how Elon Musk promised to make changes to how Twitter moderates content. So notably, he's restored the accounts of a few controversial figures like President Trump and Kanye West. And beyond those restorations of accounts of these high-profile individuals, what tangible changes to Twitter's content management policies have been made since Elon Musk's takeover?
We've sort of lived, kind of a long life in the last month or so since Elon Musk took over ownership of Twitter. And in that amount of time, I mean, I would say there's a few things. I mean, one is formally, that is the basic Twitter rules for content moderation don't seem to have changed. That is, formally, there's been no change in the actual rules. But in reality, there's been some very significant change. Musk has allowed on or activated or allowed the activation of all sorts of accounts. It's unclear how many, actually, but all sorts of accounts that in the past have been serial violators of Twitter rules around, you know, harassment, racism, incitement, and so Holocaust denialism, all those kinds of things. And so whether there are rules in a certain sense matters less because of what Elon Musk is actually doing, which is allowing people back on the platform who have violated the rules. Now, whether they are actually enforcing the rules is difficult to tell. I mean, I would say that I think as many people know, when he took over ownership, he fired a huge number of people. I mean, he fired hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are involved in actually moderating content. I mean, content moderation is a very time-consuming and somewhat big business, to be honest. And it seems that Musk fired most of the people who are doing that work, or at least many of the people who are doing that work. He fired most of the people who do content policy. Some people who were involved in what's known as trust and safety, which is sort of a part of the content moderation universe, those people left or they were fired. So in that environment, and by the way, Musk also disbanded entirely the human rights team at Twitter, which was part of an effort to ensure that, you know, Twitter was helping people achieve, enjoy their human rights in online space, particularly outside the United States, where Twitter is very popular and many people use it as an important tool to get information, to share information, to speak. So with all of that, I would say there are the rules and there's the implementation, and it's unclear what's happening, but it certainly seems likely that more and more, and there's been some initial studies, more and more content that previously would have very clearly violated the rules is not being considered as violating the rules and is not being taken down or actioned against.
Right. And we recently saw French President Macron expressing concern over these changes on Twitter and concern over Twitter meeting French and EU standards. So I guess, and this kind of relates to the earlier part of the conversation, how do Elon Musk's new sort of implementation of some of these policies, or lack thereof, comport with foreign regulations on content moderation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, what President Macron has said, we've heard from senior officials in the European Union in Brussels, that's just sort of the tip of the iceberg. Many governments are going to be, understandably upset if some of the prior rules around things like incitement to racist violence or incitement to hatred, or the kind of disinformation around healthcare, the coronavirus, COVID, and vaccines, as those rules are lifted, and in fact, that is the COVID rules, that's one area where Musk has said they're no longer enforcing those rules. I think those governments are going to be increasingly anxious about what Twitter's doing and will increasingly look to take action against Twitter. Now, what does that mean? It's unclear, to be honest. It's unclear what the countries that have those concerns will do. Some of them lack the tools to restrict Twitter. I mean, either technically or because of human rights norms, they might have a hard time, blocking that content themselves or blocking the sites. And I'd be surprised if they go all the way towards actually blocking Twitter in their, in their jurisdictions. But we're going to see increasing concern. We're also, I think, going to see some governments make real efforts to basically insist that Twitter take down content that should be totally legitimate, like criticizing the government or criticizing a government's COVID policies or whatever it might be. I think we may see governments that have historically taken action directly against that kind of content or that kind of speech, making demands of Twitter to take down that speech. And here's where Elon Musk's role as, a car salesman and a rocket salesman, let's say, may come into conflict with his role as, as he defines himself as chief twit, as the main moderator of content at Twitter. When a country like India, where, Musk wants to sell a lot of Teslas, says to him, we don't like all this criticism of our prime minister, of our government. You need to take that content down, with a hint that, it may be more difficult to sell Teslas if you don't do this. I can completely imagine that happening. And that's going to put Musk into, I don't know if I'd call it a difficult position, but it certainly would put users or independent voices in a country like India in that circumstance, which I'm just using as an example, hypothetical, could put them in a very difficult position.
Right. And there's also been concerns in the U.S., and there's even been calls for the Committee of Foreign Investment in the U.S. to investigate Musk's Twitter deal over national security concerns, precisely related to this issue of his foreign co-investors. And even President Biden has said that Elon Musk's relationship with foreign countries are, quote, worthy of being looked at. So kind of going off of your last answer, why exactly is there so much concern? And are these concerns valid? And does the committee even really have jurisdiction over mitigating Musk's investments or co-investments?
Yeah, I'm not an expert in CFIUS and how it would actually operate. But I would say that, part of the problem that Musk faces is that he has taken such aggressive action against not only kind of the content moderators by firing so many of the content moderators and the content policy teams, but he's also let go a huge number of engineers, you know, those who actually protect Twitter's infrastructure. And so there's a security concern that I imagine those who are involved in the CFIUS process will have, which is that, you know, suddenly this platform, which had, you know, more or less taken quite seriously its obligations toward user security, suddenly has fewer resources to follow that kind of commitment. And so you could imagine a number of governments seeking around the world, seeking to take advantage of potential gaps in Twitter security, which again, I don't know for sure that there are those gaps, but with the absence of personnel, it's going to be easier for, you know, governments to find, you know, security loopholes, security vulnerabilities, and how that plays out, in giving, you know, foreign actors or domestic bad actors access to internal systems, to direct messages, to private user data. All of that can be, you know, very, very problematic. And I imagine that's one of the things that concerns government officials at a time like this.
So throughout our conversation today, we've discussed sort of the lack of tools that governments have because of this tension between human rights norms and regulatory efforts. And I wanted to conclude our discussion by going beyond Twitter and the ongoing developments surrounding Elon Musk. So in the future, I want to ask, how will social media companies balance this role in free speech and moderation? And how do they manage to strike that balance with different governments and different regulations?
Yeah, no, Nicole, that's a great question. And, you know, many companies struggle with this. Because on the one hand, you know, I think this conversation has captured two different things that are going on, right? On the one hand, companies have their own kind of internal governance, which we call content moderation. And they have their freedom to define their platform in a way according to the rules that they adopt. I mean, some platforms want to be seen as, you know, quote unquote, safe or kind of friendly to all sorts of communities, maybe all sorts of ages, you name it. That's a company's right to determine the kind of platform it wants. And those rules will typically reflect, you know, what they're looking to create. But meanwhile, governments are putting pressure on companies, not just Twitter. They put pressure on Meta, on, you know, Facebook and WhatsApp in particular, on TikTok, on YouTube, on Google search. You know, going down the line, you can see governments putting pressure on companies. And sometimes that pressure is within a rule of law environment and involves, you know, formal demands of the companies that come through the courts for, you know, perceived problems of specific content. Sometimes, though, they come through illegitimate kind of acts of pressure. You know, it could be the police calling up a platform's representative in their country, or their security services calling up a platform's representative and saying, you know, we don't like this content. It's critical of our government. You've got to take it down. If you don't take it down, we're going to impose some, you know, criminal penalties on you. And so that kind of pressure is absolutely continuing. And, you know, and then in addition to those kinds of pressures, many governments, even in democratic countries like in the UK or in Europe, they're adopting new rules, imposing new requirements on the companies, particularly at a systemic level, requiring them to demonstrate that they, you know, conduct assessments of the kind of risk that their platforms might pose to the human rights of their users. Some of them are imposing or may impose in the future rules regarding specific kind of content that that companies need to take down, sometimes within 24 hours, sometimes within a shorter period of time. So there's all of this happening. And then, you know, the companies are trying to respond to that kind of pressure. And you could see some of what they do. I mean, Facebook or Meta has been probably the highest profile respondent to that kind of pressure. They've probably received the most of that pressure of all the platforms, you know, and for, you know, very good reason. But, you know, Facebook, well, when it was Facebook and now Meta, created an entire content moderation oversight board, sort of an external, you know, quasi-independent body created by Meta in order to basically be a kind of Supreme Court to address some of the hardest questions of content moderation. And they're, you know, issuing decisions about Meta's content decisions. And they're doing that in part because of public pressure, but they're also doing it because of government pressure and because perhaps also they don't always want to make these decisions themselves. Some of these decisions around certain kinds of content can be really difficult. So it's a kind of big, big universe of activity around content regulation and content moderation that involves both companies and governments really kind of struggling themselves and with each other to determine what the best way forward is.
Well, Professor Kay, thanks so much for such a great conversation today.
Great. Thanks for such great questions. I really enjoyed it, Nicole. Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.